All right, welcome to this week's episode of Double Line Minutes. I'm Jeff Mabry, back with Sam Lau.
Hey.
It's just after the close here, March 8th. It seems like I don't want to front run you on the where are we for the week, but we have a negative week in stocks. It felt like the first time in forever, but I looked and we had a negative one like 3 weeks ago. But it seems like we're talking on the desk earlier this week, and it seems like just every single day stocks up. So I guess with that, why don't we just get into the where are we going to summarize what happened in stocks, bonds, commodities?
Yeah, the S&P turned negative on the week just intraday here. So I guess that kind of speaks to how the market sentiment shifted over the course of the day in response to some of the data that we got in the macro land. But we'll get to that part after this market section. But right now, as I'm staring at the screen, the S&P 500 is down about 25 basis points for the week to date. Still positive, though, by it looks like 7.75% for the year-to-date basis. But leading the charge here were some of the smaller sectors. It looks like utilities. That's up 3.3% on the week. Materials up 1.6% on the week. And then real estate up 1.5%, or let's call it 1.6 on the round for the week-to-date basis. But those are pretty strong numbers. But when you take a look at it in those top three performing sectors of the week, those are also conversely the smallest sectors that, in terms of weight within the S&P 500. So while it helped the overall performance of the S&P 500, it couldn't bring it positive on the week. But what was negative on the week were some of the larger sectors. These are the sectors that contain some of those mega cap names that we've been talking about over the course of the last, call it 18 months or so, Jeff. But consumer discretionary down 2.6%, technology down 1.7%, comm services down 0.6% on the week, and those are the three negative performers within the S&P 500. All other eight sectors were positive there, with healthcare barely totaling the nine on the staying positive with a positive 10 basis points for the week to date there. So a little bit of this reversal, I guess, if you can say, in terms of the things that we've been talking about with the mega caps really leading the charge. They're a little bit of the laggards this week, and some of those relative underperformers on the week had, or for the last 18 months, have shown some signs of life, at least for the very, very short window here. But, to kind of exemplify that, we did see the equally weighted S&P 500, which is a concept that we talked about a few episodes ago. In terms of just some of the pros and cons between just market cap weighting versus equally weighted counterparts there. But that was up 91 basis points, kind of to reflect that the difference in weights that we see across the sector performance. Moving over to the fixed income side of things, looks like across the curve, we had a little bit of a rally here with the two-year note yield ending the week at 4.48%. That's in by 5 basis points on the yield. 10-year treasury note at 4.08%. That's in by 10 basis points. And then the bond at 4.26%. That's in 7 basis points on the yield for the week ending March 8th here. What that meant for the broader fixed income market is the opposite, the other way around, bro, here on the fixed income market as measured by the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate. That is up 0.75 point for the week to date, but still positive on a year to date basis, down about 40 basis points there. But when I look across the week to date performance, it was a clean sweep. The leading the way here is both the IG corporate credits sector as well as the agency mortgage-backed securities market as well. Those are up both about 1% there. EM sovereigns are up 90 basis points. U.S. Treasury is up two-thirds of a point there. And then down in credit, as represented by the high-yield corporate credit market, as well as bank loans, those are down about up a quarter point or so. But they were laggards relative to the more interest rate-sensitive parts of the market here. And speaking of which, those interest rate sensitive parts of the market, it looks like those are the three sectors that do have the negative print in front of them on a year-to-date basis, each down around 50 basis points to 70 basis points or so within that range. But as I look across here, it makes sense, given that the yield curve is just using the 10-year as kind of the proxy for rates, there was up 20 basis points still on the year-to-date basis, despite a little bit of a rally this week here.
It's pretty funny just looking at it right now, looking at the yield curve change year to date. It's a pretty parallel shift. Like the 2 years up 23 basis points, the 5 years up 20, the 10 years up 20, the long bonds up 23. So, a lot of times when people are doing modeling and stuff, they'll do a parallel shift up in rates. You're like, well, that never happens. And here we are, proof that it is random, but sometimes it does work out that way.
Yeah, as Jeffrey Gundlach likes to say, never is a very long time, right? So it's hard to say never out there. But closing this loop here on financial markets, the Bloomberg Commodity Index, do my eyes deceive? But I do see a positive print now for a year to date, up about 40 basis points on that basis, but not up 90 basis points on the week to date basis. Looking at WTI crude oil front month futures on a spot basis, those are down 2.5% on the week. I do see that we almost hit a, we almost broke into, maybe you can correct me, Jeff, I was on the road, but maybe we did break into the 80 handle on the front month of contract there last week, but it did look like it closed out last Friday at a dollar price of $79 spot 97 cents for the week ending March 1st. Here we are about 2.5 points lower again to a dollar price of just under $78 a barrel of front month WTI crude oil futures there.
You're not going to give if 79.97. You're not going to give it the round there
Not
to
going to
the
give it
eight.
around. I still see
All
that
right.
as a 79 handle, but that's a little bit of tough love there. But maybe it did sneak over 80 for part of that week, but it certainly didn't hold through today's close. And then moving down to the front month gold futures, that is just under 22,000, or sorry, 2,200. No shock move there. We're not 22,000, 2,200. It's at $2,185 a troy ounce, just shy of that. But that's up about 4.25% for the week to date. And then looking here at the measure of investor sentiment, sometimes we like to use this your favorite asset of Bitcoin. That has a 69,000 handle, up 65% on a year-to-date basis. So a good, sometimes a good barometer of the risk sentiment. But that was up 10 point, just about 11% on the week-to-date basis. But kind of moving in the opposite direction of some of those mega cap names that had been reflective of the investor risk sentiment as well within the equity market. So it's interesting to see that little divergence or that little differences in directionality there between those two areas.
It was
But
crazy to see the volatility into Bitcoin over the week. It was like 63, and then the next day it was like 67, then went back down to 63, and then back up to 67,000, and just that vol like every single day. I think we got this 70,000 like intraday one of these days, and it closed down like 10%, and then the next day it rallied back. So just that vol. When we do look at Bitcoin as a risk sentiment or risk indicator, that vol just continues to even put us commodity guys to shame.
yeah, that's right. That's a serious roller coaster there on the 24-hour market as exhibited through the cryptocurrency. But exchange traded ETFs have to kind of only trade a part, like a what is that, like a third of the day of that 24-hour market. So it's interesting to see how those coincide. But with that wrap up of the markets, Jeff, do you want to kick us off on what happened in the macro land today or
It was a
this week?
pretty Yeah, this weekend, mostly today, but we'll start off on Tuesday. We did get the ISM services number for February that came in at 52.6. It was estimated to be at 53, and it was at 53.4 last month. So kind of a small miss there, still expansionary. It looks like Mark Kimbrough has here that's 14 consecutive prints in expansion territory. So 14 consecutive prints above 50 and 44 the last 45 prints. So we're coming up almost on 4 years here of expansion and the services side of things. On Wednesday, we did get the ADP employment report, but it didn't really no surprise either way. So market kind of discounted that. We did get the JOLTS job openings also on Wednesday. That number came in at 8.863 million job openings. It was estimated to be 8.85, so kind of right in line there with estimates, down slightly from the last month's number. Not much movement here. Even though they did revise the last month down slightly by like 37,000. Remember that Jay Powell likes to look at the or he used to like to look at this as a as an indicator of take the jolt to the number of unemployed to see the strength of the labor market. We're at 1.44 that ratio, so down considerably from like the 1.9 that we were seeing back when the labor market was considerably stronger, and the Fed was worried about the labor market continuing to be strong and driving inflation. Also, it's interesting to always look at the quits rate. Some people actually think the quits rate is a much better indicator than their job openings number. The quits rate has declined. It was a 3.0 high. It's now down to 2.1. So the way to kind of think about that is there's a little bit less confidence in the labor market because most of the time people don't quit a job unless they have another job lined up. So having that number come down is a indicator that maybe there's a little bit more of a slack in the labor market.
Yeah, that take this job and shove it mantra, you mean, is kind of
Yes.
waning.
Well, you only say that if you have another job lined up,
Agreed.
right?
Well, you know, right? Otherwise, you're just mic dropping, I guess, and just going nowhere.
On Thursday, we got the initial jobless claims and the continuing jobless claims as usual. Initial jobless claims came at 217,000, just right almost spot on the estimate. The continuing claims 1.9 million, just slightly above the estimate here. Like these numbers have just been almost they wiggle around a little bit, but they're pretty consistent over time. They're pretty steady. We're looking at a chart this week of the initial jobless claims numbers, and it's just like once it came off that COVID spike, just been flatline at 200,000-ish or so, kind of moving up and down, but pretty much pretty stable. That this week continues that trend. And then today, obviously, Pizza Friday was the big data point. The non-farm payroll numbers came in at 275,000. That was 75,000 higher than the 200,000 expected increase. But they did the, on the so that's a positive. On the negative side, the prior 2 months was revised down by 167,000 total. So it's a you know kind of a little bit of a win here, a little bit of a miss on the revisions. Obviously, as we've talked about in the past, the market tends to just look at what the headline number is and not really look at the revisions. So it continues to be strong from this side of things. We did get on the other side though, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in the topic of the week, quick topic of the week this week. The U3 unemployment rate came in higher. It was at 3.7 last month. It was expected to stay flat at 3.7, came in at 3.9. So a pretty big or you know pretty significant increase of 20 basis points there on the unemployment rates. It's the highest we've seen since January 2022, where we had a 4. So you know the labor force participation rate actually what came in flat, did move at 62.5, was expected to increase to 62.6. And the underemployment rate actually rose to 7.3 from 7.2 last month. So it kind of interesting to see how that you know still the disconnect between the household survey and the establishment survey, but we'll get to that at the top of the week a little bit. Finally, let's talk about a little bit about the Fed speak on the week. Chair Powell was out for his Humphrey Hawkins, or I don't call it Humphrey Hawkins anymore, but that's what it used to be called. And in testifying in front of Congress, he said they're not far from the Fed's not far from a place where it'll be appropriate to dial back their rate hikes. Their interest rates are into restrictive territory. They're well above, we should also be setting the stage for rate cuts again here in the future. And then Mester came out again today, I think it was today, said she will gain confidence when she sees inflation continue to move down. The FOMC will then be in a position to start reducing the level of restrictiveness. So she expects that to happen later this year. And then really looking at the warp function here, we're looking at a 2% chance of a rate cut here on March 20th, only a 25% chance of a cut on May 1st. And we don't get to almost a 92% chance of a cut in June. So look, still Mark's still looking like June, the first cut, the kind of 50-50 in July, get that cumulative to like another cut in September, and then another cut in November. So kind of we're actually up to almost four cuts for the year now. So market's being pretty aggressive on the rate cuts. Some of that was kind of from the jobs data that we did see this morning.
Yeah. So with that, since we're on this topic of jobs, it is something that we know that the Federal Reserve will be paying close attention to. So we thought it'd be a good time to refresh our listeners on, perhaps some of the high level differences between the household survey and the establishment survey there. And the last time, Jeff, when we were talking about today, it felt like we had covered this, in an episode in the past, but it felt like we had done so just maybe a year or two ago. But now I'm looking at it. It was one of our early episodes. It was episode 9 that recorded on April 1st, April Fool's Day of 2021, where we did a pretty deep dive between the various measures that come out of those two surveys. But on top of this, we just thought that given the divergences between what we're seeing in four of the last 5 months, as Brian Kimmel mentioned in his morning note, between these two numbers, particularly within the payroll numbers versus the number of unemployed individuals, we thought it'd be a good time to refresh our listeners. So, Jeff, do you want to kick us off there on what you found?
Yeah, Sam, I was in the same camp. I started at the top of the list. I started scrolling out. I was like, we probably talked about this like within the past couple of years. You go down, all the way almost 3 years ago, episode 9. I don't want to go back and listen to it, but those of you that do, it is on our website. So there are two, as we said, the household survey and the establishment survey are obviously two different surveys. And they're kind of showing divergent data points here this week, and they have been recently. We'll start with the household survey. It is supposed to provide information on the labor force, employment, unemployment. They survey about 60,000 eligible households. And the Census Bureau conducts a survey for the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And it's supposed to reflect the entire civilian population. So they just have a bunch of questions about work, job search activities for every person 16 years older that is in the household. And they are classified as one of three states. One's employed, second's unemployed, and third's not in the labor force. If you did any work at all, were paid, or you worked for more than 15 hours, like a family business, and were not paid, you are considered employed. Or if you were out sick, or you couldn't go to your work because of the weather, or you're on vacation, you're still also employed there. Unemployed, you have to have had no job for that week. You could have worked for that week, and that you made efforts to find a job. So that's always the key, is you're actually actively trying to find a job during that week, or for the 4 weeks ending when they do the cutoff. If you met all of those conditions, you're classified as unemployed. So it's also like if you were laid off, expected to come back to your job, that does not count as unemployed. You don't have to be receiving unemployment benefits to be counted as unemployed in this categorization. So it's this, you can take the unemployed numbers and the employed, that's the labor force. And if you're not unemployed or employed, then you're not in the labor force. And the employment rate is calculated based on the number of unemployed people divided by the labor force. So the people who are not in the labor force are excluded from the calculation totally. The establishment survey is different. So instead of surveying households, they survey it, it's a they actually collect payroll data records from non-agricultural business establishments. They survey about 119,000 businesses, government agencies. It represents, they say, 629,000 individual work sites, because they like to break this down by industry, and number of hours worked, their earnings. It's all non-farm payroll data, which is why that's why we call it the non-farm payroll report. And they say the active sample includes about one third of all non-farm payroll jobs. They, sample from factories, offices, stores, government entities, whether it's federal, state, or local. And so you have to work to receive pay for any part of the reference period, including if you're on paid leave, you're counted as having a job, and you're counted for in each job that you hold. And then so they talk about earnings, earnings data, hours, private sector, public sector, and the like. So the differences really between the two, and this is from the BLS, they highlight the differences between the two surveys. And one is that the household survey includes agricultural workers. If you're self-employed, your business is unincorporated, you'll also be included in that survey. If you're an unpaid family worker, as I mentioned, that's also counts. And so those are included in the household survey. They're excluded from the establishment survey. So the household survey is a much broader base of people. So as I mentioned, the household survey, if you're on an unpaid leave, you're calculated as being employed. The establishment survey says you're not. So that's another big difference. Household survey, you have to be 16 years or older. Establishment survey is not limited by age, though. I the number of people who are under 16 that are working is probably relatively low. And finally, this is probably the biggest one that people point to, is that because you're asking a household about their job prospects, someone who has more than one job is only counted once. But if you're the establishment survey, you would be counted as having more than one job, so you're counted twice. So if you are have two part-time jobs, you're going to get counted twice in the establishment survey, but only once in the household survey, because when you know, if you get asked household survey data, you're just going to respond, "Yes, I was employed," whereas the business will have entered twice. And that's the kind of a big that's the big difference between the surveys, and that could be a big discrepancy, and it could be case in something where we see it like today, when there's differences between the outcomes of the two surveys. Sam, I know you pulled up some response rates, and we know they're low, but why don't you give people a kind of a breakdown of what they look like today?
And then just one as one other thing too, an easy way to remember the double counting perhaps that you might see within the payrolls is just you can just think of them as paychecks. The number of paychecks kind of equate to the number of people on that payroll there, or the equate to the number of payrolls there as well. But bringing it back to the response rates, we've been really hearing a little bit about the abysmal response rate that the job openings and labor turnover survey had seen over, really since the pandemic, just seeing that decline. But on the BLS site, they do go back 10 years from January 14th to, sorry, January 2014 out to January 2024. But over this last decade period, the high response rate for the JOLTS data in terms of the surveys was really around 65%, which isn't horrible. But when you start taking a look at how it's declined when it went into the pandemic and then where it's at now, today the response rate or through January 2024, the response where it was roughly 33%. And that initial sample size of establishments that are surveyed by the BLS is just about 21,000 establishments. So with that those kind of numbers, you're seeing basically a 7,000 responses through these establishments for the JOLTS data. So when we think about that, a lot of times people start to question the veracity of the data that's presented to us through that particular report. But that does come out in that so-called establishment survey alongside what we talked about there for what's seen in the payrolls report. The payroll report comes out in the separate section of that overall establishment survey. And that's part of the what's known as the CES or the Current Employment Statistics Survey. There, as you mentioned, Jeff, I think you said 119,000 different businesses are surveyed there, but that translates to roughly 600, 650,000 establishments, as these businesses can have multiple establishments under there, of which they're certainly a potential survey recipient there. So what's interesting here is with the this, I'll just call it payroll so we can keep the language consistent with the way that we reflect in the macro data. The payroll data that comes from this establishment survey, the collection period there is about 2 months. And I think that explains why they have these revisions that come through. And while we've talked about in the past, people just pay attention to the initial estimate and kind of fade the revisions. The revisions are important because they're the response rate from individuals might not come in that initial 1 month period. So they keep that window open for 2 months there. But ultimately within the decade, looking at it, the highs for the payroll surveys there was going back for the decade was at 63%. So very similar to the JOLTS data there at which was 65%. But this similarly has declined over the period of time pretty steadily since the pandemic to a response rate now that's also less than 50%. It's at a level of 43% today. So given the fact that the sample size there, the BLS has it listed as 651,000 various establishments, that gets you to just about 285, I'm sorry, 280,000 responses within that. So in terms of an absolute number, it seems pretty high, but down less than 50% of the those initially sent out. But part of that might be because of the way that they actually collect these surveys here. It seems like they can do it via fax. We always like to joke about the fact that these things are still, these government entities are still using fax to conduct these surveys. But it also looks like there's these other ways that people would choose to be non-responsive. They'll have automated phone calls something called computer-assisted telephone interviewing, which if you've ever received something similar, you know you just hang up right away if you even answer at all. There's also touch tone data entry, which sounds similar to another way of saying, they're going to call you via the phone, which could perhaps contribute to that low response rate. And then finally, the household survey, or what we refer to as the unemployment rate or the employed rate there. It comes from the current population survey that has the best response rate there. Going back in the for the past decade, January 2014 was kind of the highs. That had a response rate of 90%. Come January 2024, it's looking at about 70% response rate there. So that sample size, as you mentioned, Jeff, is 60,000 households. So you get about a 40-ish thousand response rate with regards to the household. That's also seen a steady decline, but more so, but a little bit different. That's been declining over the past decade. It did have a dip in the pandemic, similar to the JOLTS as well as the payrolls data, but that did rebound back up to kind of that trend. But over that period of time, it's had kind of that steady decline over the past decade. Perhaps part of the reason why you're getting a higher response rate is it does seem like here, in addition to a phone call for the unemployment report there, it also says a collection method here would be a personal visit. So someone might be, showing up at your doorstep. But I'm pretty grateful. I don't think I've ever had one of those surveyors come up to my doorstep. But that's what, it's pretty interesting. I mean, I guess from that standpoint, in terms of the response rate, maybe you can, have a little bit more comfort in what you're seeing in, these unemployment rates, the labor force, the number of people employed versus unemployed, versus what you're getting out of the JOLTS survey, as well as maybe even the non-farm payrolls, given that both of those have a response rate of less than 50% over pretty much since the pandemic.
Yeah, and Eric and I did a kind of went pretty in depth on the response rates. On it looks like I was trying to pull it up because I couldn't remember exactly. It looks like January 26th, but it's interesting to see that this data hasn't changed. I guess you would assume it wouldn't change because of the reason why it kind of has been much lower. But I remember there was something that when Eric and I were talking that one of the surveys could take up to like 65 minutes to answer. And I'm like, who has 65 minutes to do this once a month? And that's no wonder that the response rate is so low if it takes 65 minutes. Even like one of them is like 20 minutes. It's like, okay, well, make it 5 minutes, and you're like, I'm sure your response for the time will be much better, much faster. It is shorter.
Well, you do bring up a good point. I do recall now that the household survey, again, the unemployment one with the 70% response rate, most recently, that is a 10-minute survey, but they declined to say how long the actual surveys take for both the JOLTS as well as the payroll survey there. So, maybe they are some of those 65-minute type surveys that you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, with that, let's get on to things to keep an eye on for next week. It should be a busy week. No Fed speak, though, because of the blackout period for the Fed meeting on the 20th. But it is inflation week. So on Tuesday, we get the CPI. Month over month, headline CPI is expected to be 0.4, up from a 0.3. Core CPI, 0.3, down from a 0.4. But that would leave year over year headline CPI at 3.1, core CPI at 3.7, down from 3.9. So for the Fed, that's looking like that's a pretty good move, but it's still not enough for them to feel comfortable as a, to cut rates. We do have another 0.5 number rolling off in April, but other than that, the other CPI numbers are still pretty low. We're going to continue to see some more disinflation for the CPI to get down closer to where the Fed. We also get then we got on Thursday we get retail sales. It's estimated to bounce back pretty good to a 0.8 from a minus 0.8 last month. The so-called control group is expected to be a positive 0.4 from a negative 0.4 last month. So pretty good bounce back for the February retail sales numbers, bouncing back from both numbers we saw for January. And then also making it inflation week, we do get the PPI on Thursday. PPI final demand expected 0.3, same as flat from last month. PPI ex energy 0.2, down from a 0.5 last month. So good improvement there. That would bring the PPI ex food and energy to 2.0 year over year, and then the PPI final demand at 1.2, up from 0.9 last month. We get jobless claims as always on Thursday. Those are, as we talked about, steady, expect to be flat from where they were this week. And then we also get on Friday import prices. So this is one of the ones we like to look at. Import prices month over month expected to be 0.3%, down from 0.8% last month. And that would bring the year over year to a negative 0.7, I guess up from a negative 1.3 last month. And then we get, the University of Michigan inflation expectations. We like to look at the long-term one. I expected it to remain, but that was 2.9. So we'll see where that comes out next week from that from the inflation side of things. And with that, that's about it for this week, Sam.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to us out there today on Double Line Minutes. You don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode, or you can be informed of any of each time that we launch our spaces and get a sneak peek in terms of the topic that we'll be covering that particular week. But you can hit us up on the Twitter at DLine Minutes to send us any of your questions or suggestions for the topic of the week, or via email at minutes@doubleline.com.
And don't forget our website, doubleline.com. YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital. We just put out the most recent episode of the Channel 11. It's titled Good Times, Bad Times. And as Ken talked about at the very beginning, it's from the Led Zeppelin song. And that song has been stuck in my head ever since I listened to the episode. Make sure to follow Jeff and Sam at Sherman Show Pod there on the X to see when they come back from their podcasting hiatus. Don't forget, Jeffrey Dunlock's got his webcast on Tuesday at 1:15 Pacific time. Definitely, I know Sam, I know you and I will be there watching it. I would recommend everyone else to also listen and watch that one again Tuesday at 1:15. Thanks for tuning in and hope everyone has a great weekend.
Yeah, thanks everyone, and good luck out there.
This presentation was recorded on the date indicated. Views and opinions expressed herein are those of the individual and do not necessarily reflect the views of Double Line Capital LP, its affiliates, or employees, should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities, and are subject to change without notice. Double Line has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. The presentation represents Double Line's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media, in any form, without the express written permission of Double Line. Double Line has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from Double Line, please contact media at doubleline.com. Neither Double Line nor any of its affiliates makes any representations or warranties regarding the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this material. Liability, including any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is explicitly disclaimed. Double Line is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice. The receipt of this presentation by any listener should not be construed as the provision of investment advice by any Double Line entity or individual, nor does it imply that such person becomes a client of any Double Line entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but it does not imply low risk. Copyright 2023, Double Line Capital.